Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to this edition of News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. Keith Poston is an increasingly familiar figure to North Carolinians who pay attention to public education. The president and executive director of the Public School Forum of North Carolina is also the host of a popular weekend program on Raleigh's WRAL-TV5 entitled Education Matters. Recently, Poston sat down with me to discuss the forum's newly released list of the top 10 education issues in North Carolina for 2018. Well, Keith Poston, welcome back to News and Views. It's great to have you with us.
Always great to be here.
A lot of folks know your television show on WRAL, Education Matters, but for those who don't, maybe you could remind them a little bit more about the Public School Forum.
We've been around for, a little over 30 years. I've been, this month is my four-year anniversary leading this fine organization, and really proud of this group. You know, it's a voice for public education in North Carolina. We always say we are nonpartisan, but we do have a bias. We believe in the value of public education. We think it has a unique and important place in our society and in community, and we think it's important. And so, you know, one of the things we've been doing since we started is, you know, trying to both improve public education, you know, whether it's, recruiting teachers or, you know, elevating standards or making sure that our schools are properly funded, but also to remind the public of what public education does for this country and why it matters and why they should care, even if they don't have kids in school. So right. So our show that we have every week, not just on REL, but now on Fox 50 and UNC-TV's North Carolina channel statewide, is part of what we're doing is trying to engage the public in the issues that matter for education right now.
Recently, y'all hosted your annual breakfast on Education Policy Matters, that Eggs and Issues breakfast, in which you sort of laid out as what you see as the top 10 education issues for 2018. I'm not sure we'll get to all 10, but maybe let's talk about some of those issues.
Sure, love to.
Number one is provide certainty for students, parents, and all educators by fixing the class size crisis, sometimes referred to in the social media world as class size chaos.
You know, this is one of those issues. It was a clear and obvious one to us that it needed to be our top issue because it is literally affecting every single school and every single classroom in North Carolina. But at the same time, it's a frustrating issue for it to be the top issue because we really need to be focusing on making sure we have great teachers in every classroom, that we have great school leaders, that our schools all across the state have the resources they need to teach our children. But instead, our schools are dealing with this completely self-inflicted, manufactured crisis, which, you know, I really still can't quite get my head around why we are where we are. I told the story at the breakfast that, you know, we had this on our list last year in the draft, but then the legislature was coming back in for a special session, and it seemed certain they were going to fix this because why would they want to create an issue like this that would affect thousands of art, music, and PE teachers that would put all this pressure on school systems and county commissioners and school boards. They were going to fix it, no problem. The House had already basically said, no, yeah, we're definitely going to fix it. And then we left it off the list, and boy, it became the issue for 2017.
Let's remind people exactly what's going on here. Basically, the legislature has mandated smaller class sizes in grades K through 3, but it's essentially an unfunded mandate. They haven't provided the funding, and so it's forcing local school districts to pirate other parts of their programs in order to...
Right. It is largely unfunded. They did provide some resources for teachers, but not enough, and they took away the flexibility for how you fund teachers. And, you know, admittedly, it's a fairly complex deal, but essentially, and I hate calling them enhancement teachers or specials because I think it demeans them, art teachers, music teachers, physical education, world languages, STEM teachers, they are not directly funded in the normal class size allocation for teachers. They're kind of funded like every six teachers is an extra teacher. That's been like that for decades. The General Assembly knows that. The DPI knows that. But somehow they took that away and then lowered class sizes to these arbitrary hard classroom caps in K through 3. And again, no one has really argued that smaller class sizes is a bad idea, but it's a really bad idea if you don't fund it, because then what happens is 4th and 5th grade classes have to be ballooned up to 35 kids. So you're telling me that, okay, to get the benefit of dropping from 18 kids to 17 kids in 3rd grade is worth having 35 kids in 4th grade, and also getting rid of the extra AP courses and advanced courses in middle and high school because you no longer have enough money for payroll. Oh, and oh, by the way, it also eliminating pre-K classrooms that are in our public schools. You know, we had 40 school systems that declined extra money for NC pre-K that was actually made available, and they did it because they didn't have the classroom space for pre-K classrooms. I mean, this is just, it's crazy that this is actually an issue that is so obvious on how to fix it, which is to properly fund it and also to give the school systems time to meet it.
I'm trying to even understand these days what the argument is on the other side. I guess they're arguing somehow that local school districts are not being honest about how they're devoting their resources, and therefore this is somehow the 115 school districts across the state are all sort of part of some sort of conspiracy to deceive the General Assembly on how they spend their money.
Well, you know, there is admittedly a trust issue that goes both ways. I mean, the education community does not trust the General Assembly leadership right now. I think they've given them some reasons not to trust them over the last 7 years. So they don't trust them. And then the General Assembly feels like, hey, we've done a lot for education. We've invested a lot in teacher pay, which they have over the last few years, and we're not getting the credit for it. And so they're sort of feel like, you know, all we do is get beat up about it. And there is a part of me that gets that too, because I know there are folks that are not anti-public education down there that are trying to do the right thing. But this class size thing is really lives in the Senate, and it seems to really live in the corner office of the Senate. And
Senator
Phil Berger, and they just love this whole notion. They are wedded to class size reduction is it. There's lots of conspiracy theories out there that, oh, this is just to create chaos. I'm not sure I really buy that. I think it is just that's their priority, and we're in charge, and this is what we're going to do and get in line.
There has been talk of a fix. The House seems more amenable to doing something to take either repealing it or making some other sort of arrangement. We've seen communications from some senators talking about perhaps a fix in March. Any projections, any prognostications?
I was firmly believed it would be fixed last year, so I really don't have a lot of confidence that it's going to be fixed, not adequately. I think they'll do something so that they can say they've taken the crisis away, but I don't see how they've got $300 million laying around to fund the teachers. And even if they gave them all the money tomorrow, literally tomorrow, there's no way that in 7 months, which is when the next school year starts, that our school systems could build enough buildings and enough classrooms to meet it. It's impossible, and it's time to face that.
Speaking of building enough buildings, I think priority number two on your list is about that, about the fact that we need to equitably invest in our children's education, including their school buildings, which I assume we're talking about bonds.
Bonds. There are two bills that are currently alive in the House and the Senate to put a bond package on the November ballot, this year's ballot. We support that. It's definitely not enough. We have about $8 billion in infrastructure needs across the state right now. There's a building report that comes out every year from the DPI. So that's verifiable. It's new buildings, and it's basically new construction and retrofitting and repairs of existing buildings. The bond package is a little less than $2 billion. You know, the public school system missed out on the last big bond. It ended up being focused completely on the university system, and they needed it too. But our public schools need it, and we should take advantage of the opportunity to do that. But this issue for us was obviously larger than just the buildings. It really dealt with something that's near and dear to the public school forum's heart, which is equity and adequacy across North Carolina. North Carolina has tried to help the smaller and more rural and poor counties in North Carolina through things like the Low Wealth Supplemental Fund and the Small County Fund to close the gap, but it's not working. We are our small counties, and they tend to, and our poorer counties, and they all tend to be mostly east of I-95, eastern North Carolina. I know it's somewhat of a cliched phrase now about two North Carolinas, but we do have it. We do have it. Where you are born in North Carolina largely dictates what kind of funded school system you have. And you've got poor counties that are within an hour drive or less of Raleigh that are taxing their citizens and their properties at twice the rate a Wake County is, or twice the rate of what a Mecklenburg County is, and yet they still can't possibly touch what the larger school systems do.
And we should say it's not like all the schools, even in Wake County or in the larger districts, are luxurious palaces. I know my wife was a public school teacher for many years in Wake County. I spent a lot of August days trying to clean up classrooms that had been left to molder over the summer with the air conditioning turned off and were sort of, you know, pretty dreary, rundown classrooms. And these were in some of the nicer parts of Raleigh. And so I used to think about that when I was mopping floors those days about, gosh, I wonder what it's like, you know, in some of the really
tough parts. And that you're right. There is poverty in North Carolina in every community. And you have the same thing. You have schools. Yes, there are some really nice, fancy new schools and places, but all of our schools need additional support. You know what? Sometimes when you have schools that are underfunded, the only answer is to fund them. It's not really rocket science.
Not that complicated. Well, speaking of funding public education, another critical issue these days, of course, is the so-called school choice.
Happy School Choice Week, by
the way. We just celebrated that or endured it. What's at work here? What's going on? You all are talking in your number three priority about more transparency and accountability in charters and vouchers.
Well, we've been pretty clear that we don't think that our public dollars should be going to these various private schemes, whether it's the Opportunity Scholarship Program, the virtual charter schools, this new personal education savings accounts, which really starts getting you toward what is kind of nirvana for the school choice movement, which is universal school choice. The state basically washes its hands of any responsibility and says, all right, we spend $8,000 per child, and so parents, here's your $8,000. You can homeschool, you can go to the private school down the street, or you can go to what's left of the public school system that we used to
enjoy. What school choice folks might actually refer to as a government school.
Right. And so we've been clear that we don't think that's great policy. That being said, it's not going anywhere. The charter school growth here in North Carolina, we just this week eclipsed 100,000 students in charter schools. There's already been more than 100,000 students, which still boggles my mind, that are being homeschooled. You know, I'll be honest with you, God bless the folks that can do that in some ways. And I think that there are some parents that do a phenomenal job doing that. I can't imagine it. My daughter was so much smarter than me by the time she was 12. I would not want her to be held back by the likes of the Keith Poston homeschool. But the school choice is there, and it's a compelling message. But this voucher thing is just rife with problems. The forum put a real big spotlight this a couple months ago on the number one voucher school in North Carolina, number one by dollars, Trinity Christian in Fayetteville. $1.7 million, could probably build a few classrooms in our public schools that need them, has gone to that school. It makes up two-thirds of their operating budget. They've got a coach, teacher, who happens to also be the son of the owner of the school, you know, who embezzled money, got convicted, and now serves jail time on the weekends while teaching class and coaching the basketball team. And this is the top school. And the only reason why we know it is because of the embezzlement conviction. And what we've learned is there are such minimal standards for a school to receive these vouchers. The state basically says, they all point at each other like, well, all you have to do is be a registered private school. And then the state education assistance authority said, well, all you have to do is we give it to the family and it's up to them. And so there's not really a lot of oversight, you know, at the same time that our public schools are being micromanaged and overtested and told what time they can start and stop and how many books they can have. We're just giving away, which is not a small amount of money, almost $1 billion over 10 years, $1 billion. It's a problem. I think it's going to frankly blow up in a lot of folks' face because there's going to be a lot more Trinity Christians out there. You know, charter schools, the public school forum has been supportive of the charter school movement in its genesis as a laboratory to learn things. But, you know, it really hasn't become that. You know, it's really since 2011 when the cap was lifted, instead of a lot of sort of organic growth of these new innovative ideas, what you're really seeing are a lot of private, for-profit chains of charter schools come in. So we've almost doubled in 6 years. And I think that there are going to be some folks who I think run good charters, and I know some of them are also worried about the sector as a whole.
Got a lot of other issues. I'm not sure we're going to get to all of them, but another important one is the matter of recruiting and retaining great teachers and principals in our state. How in the heck do we go about doing that?
Well, treating them like professionals is a good start, and some of the things we just talked about affect that, and then making sure they have adequate resources and that they have that you actually let them teach and don't tell them, you sort of dictate all the various things that they do in the classroom. Teacher pay is always going to be something we talk about. We give the General Assembly credit. They actually have made some significant investments over the last 3 years. Yeah. So we've moved up. I mean, we've actually moved up. Now, our veteran teachers might not agree because they've been largely left out of that. We've also done some things that you look back on and go, why do we eliminate, you know, master's pay? Why would we eliminate retiree benefits, medical benefits for future teachers? There are things that are going to, I think, come back to bite us. We just saw some movement on principal pay. That was one that had been ignored for many, many years, and North Carolina's principals had dropped to 50th out of 51, because if you count this district comment, there's 51. And so there was some investment in principal pay this past year, but, you know, only in North Carolina can you have a pay increase where 1 in 6 will actually get a pay cut. So we're going to have to work on that this year. I hear that that's in the works, but when you turn it into, again, there is an ideological difference. This is about competition, and everything's better when you sort of, you know, have these things. And we'll see. We'll see. But we're seeing some movement that I think is important.
What about the grading system? That's another one of your priorities or issues you've identified. We have this system where we grade schools on an A through F. I believe that's what you're referring to.
Right? That's exactly it. And this is one that I really would like to have go away off of our list. It's been on our list every year for 4 years because it's a terrible policy. It means it does nothing but stigmatize schools of poverty. I mean, listen, I was just flipping to our numbers here. The schools that are A-rated schools under this system, if you have 50% or more of your students in poverty, only 10% of those A schools are in that. 90% if you have less than. On the other end of the scale of the F schools, 50% or more poverty, 98%, and 2% if you are less than 50%. This grading system tells you nothing other than, and then it does worse than that. It stigmatizes those schools, offers no support. I mean, it's not used
to stick that's used to sort of.
Yeah, it's not used to say, hey, you're obviously struggling. We need to come in and help. Well, I mean, I guess unless you count, well, we might take you over and turn you over to the Innovative School District. That's the only thing that's attached to it. This is a bad idea from the jump. It's actually, we took it from other states who realized it was bad and made changes to it, but we're still sort of clinging to our original thing, which is to measure standardized tests and say, this is why, this tells you whether a school is any good or not.
Again, my wife taught in Wake County in a struggling school with a high poverty population or higher than average. And they were a D school, but gosh, there were so many great things going on at that school in which really creative teachers and administrators were doing great things for the kids, and they were all proud of the work they did. And I know that basically they just sort of ignored that D rating and said, we're not going to pay attention to it, but it did cast a stigma on the school.
And it's hard for them to, I mean, you ignore it, but you don't, because you can feel it. And look, I think it's clear to point out when we talk about poverty and we talk about race and race equity in our report, too, we are absolutely not saying that children from poverty can't achieve. We're not saying that students of color can't achieve. But there are institutional and systemic barriers that they are living through. There are things they are bringing into the table. Literally, I had an illustration on the screen when we talked about it of like this huge backpack that they're sort of dragging in of like immigration status, homelessness, food insecurity, poverty. All those things play into opioids, childhood trauma, you know, parents who are traumatized. That makes it hard for a child to leave that and then walk into the classroom and be able to immediately sort of, all right, now I'm a student and I'm going to focus on all this when they've got all this other stuff going on. They do need smaller class sizes probably. They need a different kind of teacher. They need more resources. Yet the schools that are the poorest, as I mentioned at the beginning, are the ones that have the least resources.
I know that I also, and just to use our personal example, spend a lot of time washing clothes in my own washing machine of kids from my wife's.
I'm laundry guy too, so that's good.
Well, were her kids. These were her school kids, you know, from her class who just didn't have an ability to get it done at home. So it really was a sort of concrete lesson to me of the struggles that these kids
absolutely
confront. Well, gosh, I wish we could go through the entire list. Unfortunately, I think we don't have time to, but tell folks about, again, how they could access it, where they could learn more about the forum, maybe where they could learn more about Education Matters again.
Definitely. Our website is a great resource at ncforum.org, or follow us on Twitter at the NC Forum. There you can get a copy of our full top 10 list. And it's not just a list. it's actually a really good capsule of everything that's of each of these issues, kind of the state of things, and then our take on what we think the guiding principles should be. Yeah, check out our show. You can also watch that online every week. You don't have to, if you're a cord cutter, you don't need it. You can watch it online. Check it out.
And a weekly email is right.
Yeah, no? the Friday report. Sign up for that. We do not spam you with a bunch of other stuff, but it is a great... It's a little bit of news, a little bit of everything that the forum's doing. We also have, you know, opportunities like leadership opportunities for educators that they want to learn. We share a lot of our other education partners' news in that too. So the Friday Report, you can sign up for that on our website too.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. There's lots more to talk about. We'll do it next time. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Up next, a look at North Carolina's worrisome shortage of public school nurses with one of the state's leading experts on the subject.